Good afternoon. This is the Chorus Call conference operator. Welcome, and thank you for joining the Banca Sistema 9-month 2019 Consolidated Results Conference Call. After the presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Gianluca Garbi, Chief Executive Officer of Banca Sistema. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and good afternoon to everybody. I'm here, as usual, with Ilaria, our CFO, and Carlo, our Investor Relations Director. As you can see from the press release that we have issued this morning, we started this year with the good asset growth, and we were able to confirm this growth also in the third quarter of this year. Following the acquisition and after the merger of Atlantide, we are now originating directly the CQ loans. We have registered a quarter with growth in profitability and further balance sheet strengthening in a situation that, as you know, is quite challenging in terms of economic macroeconomic situation. I'm also happy for the result of our latest business initiative that has been launched 2 years ago, the gold and jewelry-backed loans. The business is now under a dedicated company called Pronto Pegno, and since we enter in this business, we have originated about 20 million volume with more than 21,000 individual loans. At the end of the quarter, the outstanding of the pawnbroking business has reached 10 million of outstanding with double-digit gross income. Now, I'm using, the slide. I'm in slide number 2 now. Factoring turnover is up 22% on a year-on-year basis, which is equal about 2.1 billion, and this is also thanks to the tax receivable component. The CQ outstanding exceeded 767 million, which is up 26% on a year-on-year basis. Interest income are equal to 58.4 million and are up 10% on a year-on-year basis thanks to the asset growth described above, and also following the update of accruals that Ilaria is going to cover in a minute. We have a stable cost of funding, both on a year-on-year basis as well as on a quarter-on-quarter basis, which is 0.8%. The total income is equal to 73.1 million and is up 13% on a year-on-year basis. This is all, as I said before, driven by core businesses growth. The cost of risk remains pretty much stable and is 35 basis points with an equivalent of loan loss provision of 6.4 million. The total operating cost is up, but this is mainly due to the acquisition and merger of Atlantide into Banca Sistema. The net income is up 12% and is equal to 21.4 million. The net income adjusted, taking into consideration the one-off integration expenses for Atlantide acquisition, is 21.8 million. The wholesale funding represents today 35% of the total funding and is lower on a quarter-on-quarter basis, mainly due to the lower use of ECB funding, of which the TLTRO 3 is equal to only 10 million out of a potential allowance of 300 million more or less, and that we intend to use in the following months. The total capital has reached more than 200 million and is today at 205.5 million, following to the strong third quarter result, and also thanks to the new Tier 2 bond that has been issued and settled in the last quarter for an amount of 12 million. The Core 1 ratio pro forma is at 13.4%, and the total capital ratio pro forma is at 17.2%, which are higher on a quarter-on-quarter basis. We refer, as we started last month, to the pro forma based on the expected impact of the adoption of the CQ new risk weighting coming out from the European directive that will start to apply from the 28th of June 2021. Moving to the next slide, which is slide number 3, all the three areas of business, factoring, CQ, and gold jewelry-backed loans have registered strong increase, as I mentioned before. Tax receivable, as I already mentioned, represent 30% of the total outstanding, and we expect a further growth in the next quarter. I've already mentioned on the performance of the CQ segment, and this is also thanks to a small contribution coming from Atlantide origination through its network of 20 agents and 15 intermediary that allow us to consolidate the CQ business and to have higher margin in the product. I will not comment further on the slide number 3, and I will leave the floor to Ilaria to take you through more in details of the number.
Hi, good afternoon to everybody. As usual, I will focus the comments on the main earnings figures and KPIs. Let's look at slide number 4, where we make some comments on the balance sheet. As shown in the table, total assets now stand at 3.5 billion, roughly stable, Q-on-Q, but up 11% versus 2018 year-end. In particular, the Govies portfolio has reached 800 million and is almost stable Q-on-Q with an average duration of 16.6 months, which is shorter than at year-end. Loans at amortized cost are up 12% year-on-year at around 2.6 billion, and in particular, we have factoring receivables, which are up 12% at 1.7 billion, thanks to the turnover originated in the first 9 months, as mentioned by Gianluca. They are slightly lower Q-on-Q to some anticipated collections that we have experienced during the quarter. CQ loans, again as mentioned by Gianluca, are up 18% year-on-year at 767 million. Due to banks decrease is mainly driven by the lower ECB funding. Due to customer increase is driven mainly by the massive growth in term deposits. The funding from term deposits has gone from 958 million at year-end to more than 1.3 billion at the end of Q3. And in particular, the foreign component has grown a lot, representing now 61% of term deposit stock. Debt securities are as well up Q-on-Q thanks to the financing of the new securitization, Quinto Sistema 19, that was launched in September, with an initial size of over 100 million. We now move on to discuss the P&L in the next slide. As you know, the full P&L table is reported in the appendix. On this slide, we just have a summary of the main figure. In the first 9 months of the year, interest income is up 12%. Year-on-year, where the growth is driven by higher contribution from all asset classes, factoring, CQ, and the Govies portfolio as well. If you look at the top left table, total interest income is at 80.3 million, and with 58.3 million, factoring represents 73% of it. Within the factoring, we have registered a solid contribution by your product, from commercial receivables to fiscal receivables, and also from LPI, from legal action. Specifically, within the LPI segment, as occurred in the first half, the one component that has registered the strongest increase year-on-year is extra collection. If we now look at the LPI more in detail, we see that the total contribution of LPI from legal action is equal to 24.3 million, while it was 20 million in September last year. Of the 24.3 million, accrual accounts for 15.8, of which 4.8 are related to the change of accrual rate and time value to which Gianluca referred earlier on. That followed the changes followed the update of the estimate of collection that we have carried out based on the indication of the backtesting. On this basis, we have increased the collection rates, in particular for the non-healthcare sector, and we have also lengthened the time value for both healthcare and non-healthcare. The two adjustments compensate each other, and the net result is indeed an increase of the accrual component, which is worth 4.8 million. Extra collections is worth 8.5 million, which represents a solid growth both year-on-year and also quarter-on-quarter. This quarter has been one of the strongest ones in terms of gross collections, also considering that there wasn't any sale of LPI, as you can see from the bottom right table. I should remind you that there was a sale of LPI worth 5.2 million in Q2. As a result of the dynamics that I've just described, adjusted income margin is higher quarter on quarter, driven mainly by factoring margin. As shown in the top right table, the margin is now 5.1%, while it was 4.7% in Q2 and 4.1% in Q1. So we are definitely on a positive trajectory. This quarter's margin improvement has mainly driven by the performance of the accrual component. We still see a year-on-year reduction, which is mainly explained by the factoring slight margin compression and by the fact that the CQ has now a higher weight on total customer loan, relative weight on total customer loan. As we all know, the CQ has a dilutive effect on overall margins. On its side, CQ profitability is, however, stable year-on-year and quarter-on-quarter. The stock of LPI, which is represented in the bottom left table, stands now at 138 million, of which 104 is part of the accrual perimeter. This is up Q&Q following the start of new legal actions in the quarter. The amount of LPI that so far has been recorded in P&L is worth 50 million, 50.1. We now move on to comment total income, the total income performance on slide number 6. We closed the first 9 months with a total income of 73.1 million, which is up 13% year on year. The growth is driven both by higher net interest income as well as higher net commissions. The interest income increase that we have described has more than compensated higher interest expenses. Indeed, interest expenses increase is only driven by a higher stock of funding, while the cost of funding remains at 0.8, as mentioned by Gianluca, 0.8%. Net commissions increase is due to higher commission income driven by factoring turnover growth. Since Q2 2019, so since the first half, as commented in the previous call, commission income also includes the commissions related to the direct origination of the CQ business. And this explains why the other component of the commission income shown in the bottom right table has registered a big increase. Higher commission expenses are due to the strong growth of the foreign funding raised through online platforms, so are totally expected. The Gavis portfolio has positively contributed to the total income, and also the held to collect and sell portfolio has contributed to the CET1 ratio with 8 basis points of positive impact. We could expect a further contribution of the portfolio in Q4 if we decide to sell the held to collect portion. We now move on to cost on page 7. I will not spend much time on this as there isn't much to add with respect to what we have already said in the first half. So operating costs have increased year-on-year by 14%, and most of the increase is due to dynamics that occurred in the second quarter. Personal expenses account for 45% of total cost and are higher year on year, also due to the addition of 21 headcounts from Atlantide. Today, our total headcount has reached 210 units. Other costs are higher year on year for these reasons. One-off integration costs for Atlantide merger, which have been quantified in 600K. Slightly higher admin expenses due to the National Resolution Fund contribution of 1.1 million. Then we have higher legal fees, higher IT expenses, and also we have had a contribution to the cost base by the consolidation of the Atlantide cost base into the bank cost base. Finally, we had higher net provisions for risk and charges related to a tax receivable for ongoing litigation, which is worth around 1.3 million. All these dynamics had already affected the cost base in Q2, so have already been commented in details. If we now move on to the next slide on funding, we look at slide number 8. The funding mix continues to be well balanced between wholesale and retail. Retail is now 65% and wholesale is 35%, driven by the strong increase in term deposits. The wholesale component decrease is due mainly to lower CB funding, which is now equal to 143 million, as opposed to 418 million in June. TLTRO 3 is 10 million and TLTRO 2 is stable at 123. So, and as commented by Gianluca, we have a total allowance under the new TLTRO 3 program of 295 million. As it can be observed in the bottom right table, the growth in retail funding has continued its upward trend, driven by the strong foreign component of term deposit, on which we have commented already. We might expect these dynamics to slow down a bit in the next future, as we have dramatically reduced the interest rates we offer on the foreign online platform to mitigate the massive funding inflow that we have experienced during the first 9 months of the year. We do not have any bond maturities in 2019, and we do not expect any new issuance by the end of the year, thanks to the fact that we are getting enough term funding from the new TLTRO program. In September, we have tapped the issuance of the 10-year Tier 2 bond with another 10 million, as mentioned, which was exchanged with the outstanding Tier 2 for the same amount. The impact of the exchange is 32 basis points on the first half total capital ratio, and the combined impact, including the 6 months that was issued, the 6 million, sorry, that was issued in May, is overall 75 basis points on total capital ratio. Finally, and very briefly, we want to discuss asset quality on slide number 9. Gross non-performing exposures have been substantially stable in the third quarter. Net bad loans now represent 1.4% of total loans, which is lower versus year-end. If we analyze the different buckets, we have that bad loans has increased due to the factoring exposures versus corporates. Unlikely to pay has increased due to exposure towards cities under that entered the conservatorship process and for exposure towards corporates. Past due, on the other side, is down 13% quarter on quarter. Cost of risk is at 35 basis points, which is lower versus the first half and also versus Q1 2019. I now hand the floor back to Gianluca.
Okay, so only to comment on the last slide. As you can see on the left side of the slide, the core tier 1 ratio has improved from 10.8% to 11.4%. If we take into consideration the change of RWA for the CQ, this will be 13.4%, which is an increase of 60 basis points on a quarter-on-quarter basis, while the total capital ratio has increased from 13.7 to 14.6. If we include again the reduction of CQ, this would become 17.2%, which implies an increase on a quarter-on-quarter basis of 90 basis points. The return on average equity increased, but we have to consider the fact that as more we get close to year end, clearly the return on equity that take into consideration the profit of the period will also increase. Ilaria already mentioned the increase of lower tier 2 bond and the swap with the old, with the new eligible bond. So I don't see that there is any other point to comment. Just a reminder, our regulatory capital requirement based on the SREP for core tier 1 is 7.75 and total capital ratio is at 11.85. So we are well above the minimum regulatory requirement. Now, I will end here and I will leave the floor for questions.
Excuse me, this is the Chorus Call conference operator. We will now begin the question and answer session. The first question is from Mr. Christian Carese of Intermonte. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. I have three questions. The first one is the adjusted income margin, slide number 5. I see a pickup in the margin in the third quarter. I presume if you can elaborate a little bit what is the driver of this increase in terms of margin. The second question is on the non-healthcare and healthcare collection update, if you can give us the details on the assumption now after the update on the two, let's say, division, two type of loans. And finally, on cost of risk going forward, we saw an improvement in the third quarter, and also what is the, I mean, a guidance on that, and if you can tell us your thoughts on calendar provisioning and the EBA guidelines, what could be the impact for the bank. Thank you.
Okay, so there are actually four questions. I will leave the first three to Ilaria, and I will answer to the fourth one.
Okay, so the first one on margins. The quarter-on-quarter increase in income margin has been driven mainly by an increase in factoring margin, which itself moved from 5.2 in the first half to 5.9 in September year-to-date. We represent only the consolidated margin, so the figure that you see on the presentation is the 5.1%, which is an average between factoring margins and CQ margins. But the breakdown for the year-to-date results is that the 5.1 is given by factoring margin at 5.9% and the CQ margins at 3.3%. So the factoring itself is definitely on a positive trajectory because it's moved from 5.2 to 5.9. So having said that, let's see what has driven the increase in factoring margin. The increase was mainly the result of the strong contribution of the accrual component of the LPI, which was itself impacted by two things. On one side, we have the update of the accrual rates, and on the other side, we have a strong new legal actions that has started in Q3. So the overall, the stock of LPI has increased. If your question is if we can expect these margins to continue and to stabilize at these levels for Q4, it's difficult to say now. In Q4, we will not have the change in the accrual rates, so the accrual component will probably be lower vis-à-vis Q3, but the margins coming from commercial activity as well as fiscal purchases are currently stable. So, not sure if these levels can be confirmed, but definitely we don't expect to go back to the margins we've seen at the beginning of the year.
Just a clarification, factor margins went up from 5.2% to 5.9%, and the CQS?
Stable at 3.3%.
stable.
CGS is
stable at 3.3.
Okay.
So the dilution effect is also as more CQS we buy, is more dilution effect because it's a lower margin and the product is a longer duration.
In the Atlantide, can help in terms of margins?
In the future, well, the direct CQ, yes, because the margins are higher. Today, Atlantide is a very small proportion of the total outstanding. Out of the 767, Atlantide is less than 5%.
Yes, I mean, going forward with the Atlantide consolidation and full speed, maybe the margin could
increase. But before see that visible, with an outstanding of almost 800 million, clearly there is a long way to go. There is a long way to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Second question was on the change in accrual. So we've updated the accrual rate based on the output of our statistical model. So it's not rocket science. We've simply taken what that model is suggesting us to do based on the fact that the back testing that we performed on the collections over the last 12 months has confirmed that these accrual rates are solid and can be confirmed at these levels. The change we perform is the following. The accrual rates prevailing up to the first half were for the non-ASL sector 47.1%, for the non-healthcare sector 47.1%, and for the healthcare sector 68.9%. These numbers, just as a reminder, might be different from the ones I have given in previous calls, just because they are a function of the composition of the underlying portfolio. So there might be a slight variation of tiny percentage from one quarter to another. But the bottom line is always the same. So the average accrual rate, given the composition of the portfolio in first half, was 51%. The change was performed as follows. The non-healthcare sector was increased from 47% to 60.2%. The healthcare sector was increased slightly by from 68.9%, so 69%, to 69.6%. So there was a tiny increase in the healthcare sector. Overall, the average has moved from 51% to 61.9%. In addition to the update of the accrual rates, we have also adjusted the estimate for collection, so what we call the time value. We have adopted a more, we have refined the underlying model in the sense that we have adopted an approach which is now more granular. So, decreto by decreto, we estimate what the collection time should be. And by doing that, we have lengthened the expected collection time by roughly 1 year for each segment, so for the healthcare and then the non-healthcare. In terms of impact on P&L, these two adjustments have an opposite impact, and the combined effect was still positive, so we have managed to increase the accrual component by 4.8 million, as mentioned.
Cost of risk
is lower due to the fact that provisions have come down a little bit in Q3 while the outstanding more or less being the same. As we have mentioned at the beginning of the year, we would expect to set aside more or less a constant amount of provisions for each quarter. So the reduction in cost of risk is mainly a function of the increase in the credits outstanding. Nothing to add. We believe this pattern will continue in the next quarter. As I mentioned in previous calls, the provisions that we set aside are not related to a single exposure, which is particularly complicated, but it's related to different exposures that altogether come up to the number that we set aside, prudentially set aside. In the first two quarters, we have set aside a good amount of provisions related to exposure towards cities under conservatorships, then towards exposure towards cities, towards public consortia. This time round, we set aside provisions in particular related to exposure vis-à-vis corporates.
Okay, maybe last question on the calendar provision. I try to keep simple something that is a bit more complicated, so excuse me for the simplicity. But basically, what has been changed is that the European Banking Authority has changed a little bit the definition of what is a past due. While in the past due was starting from the due date of the credit, so the due date that was written in the invoice. Now the definition is that the past due will start to be counted from when the credit is collectible. Now, when the credit is collectible, in case of a private sector, the credit is collectible and the invoice is payable when the due date of the invoice comes. While with public administration, the credit is collectible only when the process of liquidation will end. So when actually all the internal procedure of the public administration will go to the end, and the public administration will approve what is called a payment mandate. So from that time onward, you start to account and calculate the overdue. The actual effect based on what is today's situation of the European Banking Authority is is more favorable, at least as far as we can see today, compared to the past. So in the past was the due date of the invoice was the starting time for considering the delay. Now is when the process, internal process of the public administration will get to the end. And this process depends by public administration to public administration, so it's not a set date. Our experience is that we haven't seen any cases that the public administration will pay the due amount in more than 180 days from the time that they issue the payment mandate. So usually when they get to the end of the process, it will take less than 180 days to actually receive the money. So that means that for us, as far as we can see today, there's no effect on the calendar provisioning. But as you know, there are ongoing discussions with the regulator, in particular because of the impact on the private sector. So we continue to monitor what is the situation.
Thank you.
The next question is from Filippo Prini of Kepler. Please go ahead, sir.
Yes, good afternoon. I've got three questions. The first one is on the overcollection of the LPI. If you can give us a sense of what you expect in terms of overcollection for the oncoming fourth quarter. And still on the collection LPI, if your change on the time value, basically extending your expected collection time, should have a positive impact on the LPI of balance sheet. The second question is on your CET1 ratio. I see that you reported CET1 ratio pro forma with the lower absorption for the CQ business. I see that now the delta between reported and pro forma is 200 bps a bit higher than 160 bps that you reported last quarter. If you can explain this change of the impact on your capital ratio. And the last one is on your target on your industrial plan 2018-2020. If you can briefly tell us where you feel to be ahead of schedule or where maybe you feel to be behind of schedule. Thank you.
Okay, so let me start, maybe then we also ask Ilaria if they would like to add something. In terms of over-collection, unfortunately, it's not under our control. Over-collection depends on the Italian justice system and court. So on the first part of the year, we had a situation of lower than usual collection. On the second, on the last quarter, we had over collection, and so this is not something that is fully. Actually, let me say, is absolutely not in our control. They are even on the same court. It depends on the different individual judge that he set the timetable that it can be longer or shorter. There's not any specific path that can be written between a city or another city. Otherwise, we will have immediately switch all the activity where they are quicker in giving answer. This is something that is very difficult to predict. And vis-à-vis the time value, what has been done in order to be more precise, as Ilaria described before, while in the past we look at the average situation and we work on the statistical basis, this time and thanks to our colleague in the legal collection department, we have analyzed all the injunction decree by injunction decree based on the who is the judge, based on the situation in terms of possible opposition or non-opposition, and we got to a granular estimate of individual cases by cases in order to get a more precise time value. That had caused a negative effect, but the negative effect was simply because we have collected in the quarter probably more receivable LPI that were faster, so we are left with the one that is a bit longer, and that has caused a negative impact in the overall calculation. So that I hope answer. I'm sorry that I cannot give more precise answer, but simply because it's very little under our control, the process.
Just if I may add something on this. As Gianluca said, the accounting impact of the change in time value was negative by itself because we have lengthened the expected time of collection of capital. So simply by discounted value methodology, that has caused a negative impact, which has been more than offset by the positive effect of increasing the accrual rates. In the future, and I think that was your question, because of the fact that we believe we will collect later than what we had been anticipated, you're right, there is going to be a positive effect because the amount of LPI that will be accruing will become bigger simply by the fact that the capital would be probably collected later. So I don't know whether that was your point, when
there should
be a positive impact.
That's perfect, the point. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, in terms of your other question about the core tier one pro forma, not pro forma, but basically the fact that the core tier one had the impact is 200 basis points, while in the previous quarter was less. It's very simple. We have increased the amount of CQ. So as more we buy of CQ, as more the gap will widen, because in relative value we have more CQ compared to other compared to the factoring in terms of outstanding. So while the turnover of factoring keep growing, the duration of the factoring shorter, while the duration of the CQ is longer. So more we buy of CQ, more outstanding of CQ we'll have, and more impact we will have on the entry into effect of the new directive. So this gap will further widen going forward. If we continue to grow at the same pace of turnover, clearly the gap will become bigger and bigger. So we may end up in a situation in 2021 that we may, I don't know, but we may reach 300 basis points of difference between the two, between now and the entry into effect of the directive. In terms of where we stand versus our three-year business plan, I would say that most of the items are in line with the business plan. The only thing that we continue, we believe that we will be able to achieve while we are on the slightly less is also the return on average equity. The range was on the business plan from 18 to 24%. We are now at 17.6%. But again, this need to be seen in the annualized basis. And so I think that this can be achieved as well. Clearly, when the new directive will enter into effect, that is 1 year after the business plan, so at least 6 months after the 2020, clearly we will end up with either a very high core tier one, and at that point either we distribute more dividend, and this will allow us to increase the return on average equity, or we will have a very high core tier one with a lower return on average equity. Depends what is going to be the policy in terms of dividend distribution at that point. It could well be that in the meantime there could be some extraordinary transactions, so the spare capital will be used for something else, for some acquisition, for instance.
Okay, many thanks.
Thank you.
As a reminder, if you wish to register for a question, press star and one on your touchtone telephone. The next question comes from Matthias Teig of Rothorn Partners. Please go ahead.
Hello. Matthias Teig, thanks for taking my question. I'd like to ask about the non-performing loans. You mentioned that the increase of, let me see that I get it right, unlikely to pay loans is to some extent due to the increase with corporates. That sounds different from non-performing loan exposure in the past. If I remember correctly, you never had any losses, any actual losses from non-performing loans against public authorities. Is there now a risk with those non-performing loans against corporates?
Yeah, when I said corporates, I meant factoring activity where the debtor is not a public administration entity, but it's a private company. As you know, most of our business is towards public administration, so we have a very low risk-weighted absorption, but there are situations where the debtor of the receivable that we buy is a private company. So it's what we call private versus private factoring. For some of these positions, we have had to move the exposure from the bonis category to either unlikely to pay or bad loans. An example of activity of business that we do with private versus private company is the football business. I don't know whether Gianluca wants to add something
Actually, technically is a private entity, but practically is what we consider a public sector risk. So, for instance, we don't think that football league will default. Technically, the football league is a private entity, so need to be classified as a private. So, Ilaria was absolutely correct when you say that there is an increase due to private exposure, but actually this is something that we consider as close to public sector.
Are these factoring loans with recourse against corporates?
In some cases are, in some other cases are not. So sometimes, and this is also the other impact, because when is without recourse, in case the obligor is the public administration, this is considered as an exposure towards public administration. When is with recourse and there is a delay, we have to consider as an exposure versus the seller, i.e. versus the private. So in this case, but in the particular cases of this delay, I think that one, as far as I remember, the one that I think that Ilaria had in mind is without recourse, so it's actually the league, is the football league, the obligor, that is withheld in the payment over the due date. And for this reason, we have to classify as an unlikely to pay.
Yes, correct.
Okay, thank you. I guess you will keep us updated in the coming quarters of how this develops.
Yes, absolutely. To give you an idea, in terms of relative weight on the outstanding, given 1.9 billion outstanding of our factoring activity, the exposure towards what we call private companies is for around 300 million, which is equivalent to 17% of the exposure. And within this cluster, we also have the league or other, you know, public entities that cannot be considered public administration, so we classify as private companies. So it's a minor component of our business.
Another example of the same category is the National Railway. The National Railway is fully owned by the government, but technically is private. So for us, that is classified as an exposure versus private. And because it's an exposure versus private, if they don't pay on time, this will end up to be overdue. And that has to be treated in a much tougher way compared to the public administration.
Another example is what we call public consortia. So the consortium itself has to be classified as a private entity, but the shareholders of the consortium are in most cases public administration entities.
The typical consortia are the water company. So in Italy, the city owns the water pipes, and these are owned through various cities in the form of a consortium among the city. The city are those consortium are debtor of in particular electricity companies, because due to the use of electricity for pumping the water, they have a huge exposure versus electricity company. So in this case, the fact that the city are the owner of the consortium doesn't allow us to classify with the look through and look at the public administration, but we have to classify those consortia as private, and therefore, if they don't pay at the due date of the invoice, in 90 days after the due date of the invoice, and they never do that, these are non-performing.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Garbi, there are no questions registered at this time, sir.
Okay, thank you very much, and have a good evening to everybody. Thank you, bye.